mentioned this year. This is my third year at NAFB. When I joined the U.S. Department of Agriculture, I came up with Eric Parsons. You all might remember Eric, who brought me out as his protege. I was born and raised in Wisconsin, and after 9/11, thank you, all six of us. But I came out here after 9/11. I came out to Washington, D.C., been in the motion picture business and in television news. And I'd come out to Washington and try to make a difference. I was one of those that said, okay, I got some skills. There's got to be something I can do. My wife thought I was a little insane when we moved out there without jobs. But nonetheless, it worked out well. I started off at Voice of America, then got a full-time job at USDA. I have to admit, when I was coming out to fight terrorism, USDA wasn't exactly at the top of the list of where I wanted to land. But once I got on there and found out about biosecurity and the food supply and the different plots against that, it seemed to be a perfect choice. I worked in FSA, at the Farm Service Agency, in public affairs. And then a presidential directive came out saying, looking for people to go to Iraq to do public affairs in Iraq. And I have to, let me confess what my biases are. I'm Christian, and I'm Republican, and I'm a Packer fan. And it's the Republican part that I wanted to address, because going over there, I know that this war has got both ends of the political spectrum. And I don't understand. I've been working for the federal government for 2 years, and I'm no longer there, so I can be very candid. I don't understand that partisan crap. It's just crazy. I never, you know, from an idealistic standpoint, as a citizen, I just never thought it was that severe until I got involved in it. And that was one of the reasons that I wanted to go to Iraq, is because of what the military is doing there on a day-to-day basis. It's not Republican, it's not Democrat. It's an incredible work that they're doing. And so when I went over, I took my television package. So as I went through Iraq, I had my Canon XL1, my Marantz 660, and I also had my camera. And I was a one-man show, because we didn't have in place anybody who could do media out in the country. You had public affairs people with the military that were covering combat, but nobody was covering the progress that was being made. So I traveled throughout the country with the military, not looking for political stories. It wasn't about supporting the administration. It was about looking to find out, what is the military doing to increase agriculture? In the country of Iraq, agriculture is the second largest industry behind petroleum, but the largest employer. They get all of their food is dumped into the marketplace from Syria and Jordan and Turkey at ridiculous prices. You can buy 20 pounds of tomatoes for 50 cents. Their beef is buffalo that's shipped in from India. Their cows look like oversized German shepherds. They had 1955-era technology, and their equipment looked like it was out of that. These people had been under oppression and tyranny for 30 years under Saddam, and their agricultural condition was a disaster. But what I wanted to really share with you that's important is many of you gave voice to the broadcast that I sent back from Iraq. My job is, as you know, I tailored all my remarks and told you that I was with the State Department. You could factor in the biases. I really wasn't cognizant of whatever biases might be out there, because I guess the only bias that I really had is I was very pro-military. Watching what these men and women did, I mean, 18 and 19-year-olds and 50-year-olds and 60-year-olds and grandfathers and grandmothers, and on Mother's Day, and there would be ladies carrying their M16 and showing me pictures of their 16-month-old that, you know, Mr. Mom husband is back home taking care of as they go out into a combat patrol. What we're seeing our military doing on a day-to-day basis defies imagination. And to serve alongside of them, there is no greater honor. And I tell you, watching them having no particular agricultural expertise, one gentleman in particular is chief financial officer of a company called Rooms to Go, if you've ever seen on the side of the highway and they have prepackaged rooms. Chief financial officer, and he's running the agricultural programs on a full-time basis in one of the most violent provinces in the country. And the only thing he knows about agriculture is that there's a certain way you thump a cantaloupe to find out if it's ripe. Those were his words to me exactly. So that's all I know about it. And I said, so how do you give expertise to the Iraqi farmers? And he said, I send emails back home and say, don't we have a cousin who's got a farm somewhere that can tell us what you're supposed to do with that? That's the level of the expertise. And that's one of the reasons that Susan Littlefield had developed the farmbridge.com to help connect Iraqi farmers and American farmers and the expertise. But I want to tell you, as I traveled the country and did my radio reports, the U.S. government and the military was amazed when they would do their LexisNexis searches and do their reports around the country to find out that in some of the reports I was sending back to NAFB, we were getting 3,500 radio station hits, online blogs, and newspapers across the country. You got to understand, these are folks that were used to getting five or six. I would sit in the weekly meetings with the general, General Abizade to begin with, and then General Petraeus at the end, and we would have lists, you know, PowerPoint presentation of media stories that would hit. And their media stories about a surge would get seven hits, and then they would go down to an ag story about farmers market, and there'd be 3,700 hits, and they'd look at this and go, what's going on? It was you folks. And it was one of the things that I was trying to convey to the military and to the State Department is saying, guys, there is something other than the New York Times and the Washington Post. There are the middle America, you know, where the sons and daughters that are out here fighting, where they actually live, and where the people care about what they're doing. I was telling Chuck, Mr. Zimcom, that it would happen almost on a daily basis that I would get called into the ambassador's office with a thing that came from the White House saying, in case you missed it, about this agricultural story that was posted on any one of Chuck's different blogs, and somehow this guy has figured out a way to get all of his stuff into the White House. So if you want something to reach the president, go to Chuck. He'll take care of it. But I want to tell you one quick story, and then I'm done. But in February, I was invited to go to Diyala Province, where I lived with four Iraqis for 50 days. We didn't have running water, we didn't have sewage, we didn't have electricity. They had an old abandoned radio station, and the mission was to get it up and going because they wanted to have an independent voice. We're at a combat outpost just on the outskirts of Baghdad, between Baghdad and the Iranian border. Out on the roads, you can hear the IEDs going off. We had only 40 soldiers protecting us. For those of you who've been in the military, you know what it's like when you don't have sewage facilities. You know what it's like when you don't have running water. I mean, it's nasty. And my job was to bond with the Iraqis, so I lived with them. I slept with them. I ate with them. I ate what they prepared, if you could call that food. It was nasty, but we developed a bond, a relationship. While we were trying to build the facility, I had a satellite phone, and I was able to do interviews, some live interviews back and forth. And the one interview in particular stands out. We had our Sunni broadcaster on the line with Pam Fretwell, and Pam asked him a question. Well, what do you think about America and about invading the country? And all of a sudden, this guy went off, and he was railing on America, and he was railing on the president, he was railing on the military. And I'd just been living with him for a couple of weeks and having lots of conversations, and I'd heard nothing of that in the past. And so when he got off the phone, I sat down with him. I said, you know, that's interesting. I said, you're welcome to that opinion, and I'm glad you expressed it. I said, but you've never said anything to me that you were anti-American. He said, well, I'm not. And I said, so why did you say it? He said, because that's what the American media wants us to report, is what we hate about the Americans. And I said, well, maybe in general terms. He said, no. And so he showed me the emails from the CNN that had done an interview with him a couple of weeks before, saying, tell us why you hate the president and wish we hadn't invaded your country. Tell us. And then there was one from the New York Times. And I looked at this and I said, oh my gosh. You know, we have such a distorted opinion about what the basic Iraqis feel about Americans. We're convinced that they hate us. We're convinced that we've caused all these problems. Folks, having lived with them, having talked with them, I can assure you, with the people I spoke with, and I can't speak for all the folks in Iraq, they were grateful that we came in and liberated them, not necessarily from Saddam, but everybody was afraid of his two sons, Uday and Qusay. They figured that's where it was going to get really bad. These people were grateful. Now they were ready for us to leave, but with repairing 5,000 of their tractors and rebuilding their hospitals and all those kind of things, they're very grateful for the liberation that's taken place. Last thing I want to share is when I went back to the radio facility, we We had a transmitter in the back. Let's put it this way. We had a beautiful facility, modern equipment, but we couldn't get on the air. That's a bit of a problem if you're trying to be the independent voice of Iraq. We had no ability to use this 1,000-foot tower that was behind us. Back in the barracks where the 50 soldiers stayed, there was an old transmitter from Saddam's time that was sitting there, and some of the soldiers had their posters on it and a clothesline and all that kind of stuff. And I said to the Iraqis, well, what is that old thing? And they said, it was one of Saddam's old transmitters. I said, does it work? And they said, no, it's not connected to anything anymore. It's just sitting there. I saw in the back with a little label. It was made by a company in Bologna, Italy. Went inside, got an internet connection off the satellite dish, Googled them. They're still in business in Bologna. Sent them an email and said, anybody speak English? They said, yeah. And I said, you know, here's the model number. It's like something from the 80s. Is there any chance it can work? And they said, well, that particular model, we put diodes on the top. If you got jumper cables and a 12-volt, put them on there and it may fire up. That thing roared to life at 12:30 a.m., fired up in the middle of the barracks, and all of a sudden the lights on the tower are going up, everything's firing up. We went from a nice facility with no broadcast to being the largest broadcaster in the country of Iraq with jumper cables. But once that happened, I can assure you, we became a target. We became a target all over the place. When I went back to do more training in May, you might recall in May when we had three soldiers that were captured, and we didn't know where they were, and we're on a massive look for them. And I was at the radio station at the time when I was told, and I kind of went silent with all of you, so there was a time frame that I went dark because we were in the middle of some serious work, and we'd gotten intel that our soldiers who had been captured south of Baghdad were just a mile away from us being held in an Al-Qaeda camp. And now, mind you, we only had 40 soldiers at our place. And so they told me that everybody was going out on the mission at 1 in the morning, and that we're going to have only three soldiers left back at the base, along with me and the Iraqis. And they gave me a weapon and said, we should be fine, but if we're fine with me and a weapon, you got a problem. So they went out and did the thing, and they were doing the mission, and about 4 in the morning, the one sergeant comes up and he said, listen, we got a situation coming in. We're bringing in 40 refugees. We got into the Al-Qaeda camp, and we liberated about 40 Iraqis that have been held there, and they're bringing them over here to the radio station. And I said, that's great. So all of a sudden, the truck pulls in, and we got 40 liberated Iraqis that come in, and they want me to do the media. So I've got the TV camera, and I got the Marantz going, and I'm clicking still shots. And we bring them in, and these people have obviously been in a horrible situation. They come in, and they stink, and they're thirsty, and they're hungry, and all this kind of stuff. And they want me to do the stories for the military, because there's nobody else around. We're pretty isolated. So I'm starting to do TV and radio on all of this. And they tell me the stories about one guy in particular told me how that the how Al-Qaeda had held him up and tied him, and they beat his back until he would agree to be a suicide bomber. And I said, when did they beat you like that? And he said, just 5 days ago, until I was bloody and I passed out. And we went on with that, and I thought that was phenomenal, you know, these stories that I was hearing. And then something inside of me as a journalist said, hey, let's go outside. I want to get a nice close-up of of your back. And went outside with him and took a picture of his back. He pulled up his shirt. Nothing on his back. And there was part of me, I'm saying, you know, these guys, for being refugees, are actually looking pretty good and well-shaven. And it was at that time that the military came up and said, we want you to do this and interview them, etc., because basically these are the 40 Al-Qaeda guys that we just captured. I'd already played ping pong with them, posed for pictures. And, of course, they had to do that with me from the standpoint that, you know, had I known 40 terrorists were coming in, and there's only three people with guns, because all of us are out on this mission to find the other people, and it was probably, in retrospect, a smart move. But I can assure you, as an amateur broadcaster and a fledgling journalist, that was about as close as I want to come to the face of Al-Qaeda from the future. All that to say, there's stories like that, a million of them. But I'm so grateful for what our men and women in uniform have done, and I'm very grateful to you, because if it weren't for you opening up your airwaves and airing the reports that I gave back from Iraq, those stories wouldn't have been told. And what these men and women in uniform do on a daily basis is mind-boggling. And as they come home, hug them, love them, encourage them, they are American heroes. And you folks are heroes for just airing their stories. God bless you.